Good evening.
Good evening.
I thought I was at home chanting the sutra. Forgot I was here. We have a new face tonight. Welcome.
Thank you.
How did you hear about us?
Well, highly recommend me to go to Flowing Zen group, and here I am.
There you are. Thank you, Yap. So let's do introductions around.
Yap.
Ellie.
Leslie.
Mimi.
Steve.
Nico.
Jeffrey.
Marie.
Karin.
And Angie. So I couldn't get the book yet. It's not available except from... It's not available to download on Kindle. It's not available at Amazon except from far away. Amazon doesn't carry it. Mm-hmm. Other people do. So I've ordered one. So Amazon very kindly gave me the introduction. And I thought, okay, that's enough. The book, Mimi, is The Four Noble Truths, Buddha's most basic, very first teaching. And we're just starting. So, with the Dalai Lama's book about the Four Noble Truths. So, this is, you come at a good time. It's the very beginning. And I loved that introduction. That was so sweet, of course, because he's like that. And he was most concerned in the beginning of it with other people's religions. He said, don't worry about it. If you have another religion, you should probably keep to it. If it means the most to you, well, don't just try to pick up Buddhism and make that your thing. Do what has deep meaning for you. And he said, all teachings have kindness and compassion in them, and you should respect all religions and try to work together with all religions. So from the very beginning, he just took everybody in completely. And then he said, but I love Buddhism the best. I thought, yay, so do I. So, of course, he would want to speak about that and make sure that it's well understood as much as he understands it. And he'd been picked up as a very small child and had been studying it ever since. So, then he talked about the difficulty that some people find with one of the principal understandings of no self, and that it's really a very crucial understanding. The original teaching in Hinduism was a self, that there was a self here and a self in the heavens somewhere. And the whole effort of religion was to connect with the self, to create a tie. That's what yoga means. It's creating a tie with between heaven and earth, between human being and the ultimate, the absolute. And Buddha had another kind of experience. He kept trying to make that connection. Over and over, for years and years, he tried and tried. He tried to torture himself in order to get over the body, his attachment to the body. You don't need this body. It's not in the body. It's deeper than that. How can I get that connection? And finally, almost dead, he decided maybe there was another way, that maybe he should try something else. And so he stopped starving himself and stopped living in the jungle. He went to a little river, and a girl offered him some food, and he accepted it. And his friends were horrified and thought he had abandoned them completely and done a very bad thing for eating food like that. And that's when he sat down under the tree and really began to consider what his life was. Not just this attachment that he felt, but what is this? So when he was finished with that whole experience, and it was quite a long one, some weeks, he felt the connection right here, not up there somewhere. He touched the ground. He said, he had a challenge from one of the gods. He said, who says you have a right to this? And he said, the earth is my witness. I have a perfect right to this. And what he saw was the truth of suffering. So what he gave was the truth of suffering in these four principles. And that's what we're going to study starting tonight. So he discovered two very essential things that everybody who studies Buddhism begins to understand. Probably the most important one, besides no self, which, as Dalai Lama said, creates people shivering and shaking with fear, because if they misunderstand it, they think, oh, I'm dead already, you know, I'm not here. It doesn't mean that. It just means that our attachment to our great self, whatever we think about ourselves, is a very tenuous, very transparent, and very often silly thing. It's not true. We don't really know the truth of ourself. If we study carefully, we are an expression of something, and then we notice what we're expressing, and we say, oh, that's me, because I did that. I said that. But I didn't say even these words. They're just, I don't know where they're coming from. So it's not a dramatic and exciting kind of principle, no self, anatman. It just means that our self-attachment gets terribly much in the way of the truth of things. If we want to know what's true, we don't get off on our self-importance and a notion that we're here forever and that we're either the best or the worst of the human race. All the self-consciousness and the self-focus that everybody gets so lost in, because we have a brain. And our brain is always working, 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 spinning, spinning. So our work is to actually study what's going on in us, get to know it, and become familiar with our effort to see what's true in this moment, in this situation. There's not an overall picture of truth. There's only just this one. This, here we are, over and over and over again. So the other thing that he was emphasizing was nonviolence, which is another way of talking about compassion. And that's actually essence of Dalai Lama. They say he is Avalokiteshvara. Every Dalai Lama is the Avalokiteshvara embodiment of compassion. And you could easily say so if you've been exposed to his teaching. So his take on this, even though it's a so-called Hinayana, small vehicle teaching, meaning it's a fundamental teaching, it's the first teaching. So there are whole schools that base everything on this teaching. And its aim in those schools is to see, understand through meditation, through deep, deep practice, the truth of these things, and to transcend, personally transcend the suffering of life. To, if you really, really do it right, you can be done with this. That's not Dalai Lama's view, because his is much more like Zen view, which is Mahayana, what's the great vehicle. It's a horrible comp. The language is really wrong, because it all is a part of how we practice. We practice with those first teachings, but transcend those first teachings with compassion and care for others first before we care for ourselves. That we actually dedicate our life for the care of all, even as we take care of and honor ourselves. So it isn't that we disappear ourselves or degrade and demean ourselves. We, in fact, more and more honor and respect ourselves. We're absolutely incredible. Each one of us is really amazing. And if you look deeply into your life, you'll see that. And you'll see it's you. But it's not exactly you. The whole thing is a great work, a great dynamic at work all through those of us we know each other, and those every stranger that we meet, not to speak of the forests and the oceans and the stars and the rocks and everything is moving and changing continually. I've been reading since I couldn't read Dalai Lama. I've been reading a book by Chogyam Trungpa about Milarepa. I thought it was a translation of Milarepa's poems, and it was just a commentary on them. But it was a very interesting commentary, with a few little quotes of a little bit of poetry, but not much. But he talked a lot about the difference between Mahayana and Hinayana, and connected it to Vajrayana, which is the Tibetan practice. And they see it as a sort of ladder. You start out with the Hinayana down here, and then you climb up to Mahayana, and then if you're really, really studious and good, you can climb all the way up to Vajrayana. But actually, when you look at the Vajrayana teachings, it's just like our teachings. It has all of it in it. It's all just trying to express something that's the same. So it's had more than 2,000 years to develop into very complicated and lots of academic work around it that is very interesting and sometimes extremely important to know about, because each one of us acquires an insight into these teachings that is based only on our own life and experience. But seeing it reflected in others all through history gives it back to us, gives back our own self to us, our own understanding and insight. It's the wonder of reading that we meet another mind and it reflects our mind and nourishes it and encourages it and keeps the whole understanding of the truth alive in us, in our time as well. So he said, Hinayana is about finding the pain, actually just stopping long enough to realize that we're all in terrible pain. And in more than one kind of pain, he actually, in his view, he says, the notion of samsara is suffering. The notion of everyday life here on the ground, on earth, is really, really painful and hard. To begin with, the suffering that exists in ordinary life is very real, absolutely real. The suffering of suffering that exists with that suffering is unreal or questionable. And beyond that, there is basic suffering, which is always present with us. So samsara is a gigantic bag of confusion, says Chogyam. Confusion, lust, and aggression. We know that in America there is immense aggression and resentment in regard to ourselves, our parents, our relatives, our teachers, everything around us. We do not dare to work together with the world. So he calls our basic pain cosmic suffering. The basic ache of uncertainty and resentfulness. I didn't ask to be born. Who said I had to break my leg? Or live in this lousy place? Or whatever it is that we are grumpy about. And of course, everyone is grumpy. There's a grump who lives inside every human being, I'm sure. And there's a suffering of suffering, which is realizing we have to accommodate unpleasant situations when we don't want to. He says there's one chaos after another. Oh no, I've got to do this thing. I hate to do these things. Ugh. He said ordinary suffering is a feeling that reality is workable. Life's very ordinary. And it's threatening. And it is. We're going to die. It's dangerous out there. And we have to be really careful. He said, it is threatening, but you work with it. You work with it. You work with your fear. You work with the conditions that you find yourself in. And it ain't easy. And we all know, and we all talk about it and complain about it, and go right ahead and do it. I look at that now from a very long distance from the beginning of my life, and I'm just amazed. I can't imagine that I did all those things. If you told me back then I would have done, I would not have believed it. It's just amazing what we've done, what we've endured. And yet, here we are. And we're about to endure something else, because we always are. There's always something up ahead. So he says, on the Buddhist path, we cannot live without suffering. There is no way. And as Koban always pointed out, as soon as you sit down in Zazen, you realize how much you hurt, physically hurt. It just hurts to sit down for a long time. He says, actually, you're hurting all the time. You just don't notice it. Because you turn on the TV, or you jump in the car, or you think a thought or something to change the subject. Oh, I don't want to think about this. But you can't do that if you're sitting. So they say, you know, your pain is your friend in Zazen or something. It's just such a mean thing to say, but it's actually true. It's such a big help, because you finally have to actually endure it. Realize how much you're enduring. Realize how strong you are, how tough life is. And maybe more things as well. How your mind is working. How your mind works with the pain. How it works with aggression. How it works with things you don't like. We're always kind of like this. Wanting more things, or not wanting all those things. And all of that is that suffering of suffering. It's adding on to it, because we're trying to enhance this self that we think has so many needs and is so special. Says the ego's basic function is holding on to a particular thing very hard and tight. So as long as we're holding on and can't change our mind, that's the ego. And he says we need our privacy. Our ego is our most private part, and so we're always hiding the garbage, hoping people will think we're good persons and that they might save us. So if you come on a neighbor and you don't usually show everything that you're feeling and thinking, especially if you don't like the neighbor, you just say, oh, hi, hello, and fine, and off. But actually recognizing that in us when it happens is really, really important. Oh, there was one more thing in here. So he outlines the Four Noble Truths like this. The view is the wisdom of knowing emptiness. Knowing that things are not fixed. it's all interconnected and it's all moving and changing continually. The meditation is the process of opening up, opening the mind. The action is continued non-attachment or transparency. To be transparent means we just meet each thing in our life without anything extra. Just allow our self to be seen through. And the result is immaculate nakedness, he says. You can't label it or cling to it. It's you and it's not you, but there is no way to express it. It just is. Those are also aspects of the Eightfold Path, which we can talk about later, because the Eightfold Path is the conclusion of the Four Noble Truths. It's the fourth one. And it, all by itself, wonderfully outlines how to live in a very simple, basic way with this suffering, with this human life, with this connection with the earth, and with everything. Everything. So next week I will have the book, and we can continue from there. Are there questions? Comments?
Group bus commentary.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have a sense of suffering and suffering of suffering, but what was the basic suffering that he described? Because I think those were three different ones.
Right. The basic suffering is everyday life.
Right.
And then there's the suffering that you break a leg. And that adds to it. And that's not the suffering that you can do anything about except go to the doctor and get it set. But then there's the suffering on top of it. The person who says, oh, I broke my leg and this is terrible. And why is it happening to poor little me? I'm a good person. Why did they do this to me? You know, going on and on and on. So that's extra.
Right.
And that feels terrible.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
but then what is the basic suffering? That was the third thing. Or was there just...
Cosmic suffering.
Exactly.
Is the basic ache and the resentfulness.
Okay, so that is kind of the suffering.
Yeah.
Okay.
The basic ache. Just like our human condition thinking we need to get something.
That's part of it. Yeah. Yes. We always need to think we need more. Yeah. And in fact we do. If we don't have another meal, we begin to feel it. And if we don't get food after a while, we die. So we do need more. We just don't have much of a sense of how that works in us. How to be discreet about our desires.
I didn't think that's what was meant by the basic ache. That seems like a more basic ache. Like surviving on a day. I thought
persuading thing that we need something beyond just enough.
Yes, exactly. That's what I meant by discretion.
Okay.
That if we're not discreet about our desires, then we want more and more, and we aren't glad about a little house. We want a bigger house, and we want more food and more of everything. It's the American way, right? Yeah.
So I just wonder, being a human being means to embrace the suffering. So why do we want to reincarnate to be a human being then?
We can't help it. It's what we get. You know, kids, when they're mad at their parents, say, "I didn't ask to be born." No, we didn't really ask to be born, unless you believe that, I mean, there's a whole system of belief around that, but I think most of us have a sense that we just popped into the world, and then we have to somehow understand where we are and who we are. So I don't think we have a choice. Jeffrey?
Well, I think for myself, dukkha, this pain, this suffering we're talking about, what I appreciate most about Buddhism and about especially Zazen, opportunity to sit with our own minds, to sit with our own suffering, because not any of us have exactly the same kind of suffering.
Yeah.
I did a lot of gardening today, and my 71-year-old body is feeling some pretty interesting aches and pains. But I'm not suffering from that. It's you know those things that you do that you're going to have some sort of ache and pain from, but it's almost a joyous ache and pain. As opposed to other things that when you walk out the door here and you trip and fall,
yeah. That
kind of thing, which is not joyous.
Yes.
And so much about our suffering is so subtle and requires a lot of examination and thoughtful reflection in terms of what is really happening.
Yes.
Because so much of what we're talking about deals with our how we deal with change. And so you can see as people grow older, you see how they have considered aging and their accompanying illnesses, whether it's a creeping arthritis, something that as a result of surgery, and just things you cannot avoid. But the practice of sitting with our minds is something that we can embrace.
Yes.
You know, as long as we have that ability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just thank you. It's just one more wiggle in the brain, really. It's, but it can be intense.
It
can be very intense and very difficult. And that's one of the reasons why we need to help each other. Because we all know what pain is like. So when we see someone else suffering, we can reach out and really connect because we know already what that is. That's a big part of the practice, too.
So thank you for bringing that up, because, you know, definitely the Bodhisattva ideal comes into play in this discussion.
Yes.
Because we do encounter people all the time, unless we're trying to avoid people. But if we're embracing the role of interacting and coming face-to-face with people, we will come to face with their suffering.
Yes.
And We don't know exactly how they're doing, but one of the things that I find is that there's increasingly more and more tools that are interpersonal that are available to us. The more we're willing to look at it and work with it and be with it. Not strongly embrace the idea of our Buddhist community as providing us those tools. I find again and again and again I can go find a person, or I can find what I need.
No, oh, thank you, Jeffrey. Oh. Leslie?
Thank you for bringing Trigam's teaching into this. First I want to say, sort of not my commentary, but I feel a little guilty because I'm the one who told Marie that it was available on Amazon because I didn't try to buy it because I already had it. So I'm really sorry if you all have had trouble. And I'm more than willing. I can scan the next chapter and give us, again, just send it to Marie as a PDF. So
well,
that
that's a good idea.
Could have it available.
That's a great idea.
It's a wonderful idea.
So do you want the chapter after the introduction
absolutely.
For us to start with?
Absolutely.
Okay.
What a great idea.
Okay. I'm more than happy to do that.
Super.
I let us down this garden path, so to speak. but what I was going to say is that today I just happened upon an essay, probably a talk given by Norman Fisher from Zen Center San Francisco. And it's on an entirely different topic, but part of what he was talking about was how that what we're studying now in English are kind of third and fourth translations, especially in Zen. You know, it was Sanskrit, and then it was Chinese,
right.
And then into the Japanese language. So, but that language is talking about concepts, and as each one of those translations happens, there are often concepts in the original that don't have words in the next language.
Yes.
And so in that translation, he says, Buddhism is born over, so it's completely new in the next language. So then, by the time you get to English, you know, I'm sort of thinking. But I read somewhere else that dukkha, the English word suffering, isn't exactly it.
Right.
That one of the things we struggle with is just that idea. I think there's so much emotional baggage with suffering, you know, just the subtleties that you were talking about between an ache of pain that was joyfully stimulated or something caused, that the causes of that inform how you can be with it. Anyway, I just thought I'd offer that as well, that if we struggle with this a little bit, it might be because of the original idea.
Of course, that's a very good point. And so it's why we sit, because the sitting is the experience that all these words are trying to point to, the experience of sitting. And we try to pin it down with words, and of course we can't. And we try to translate it, and translate what somebody else said about it, even in English. There are different points of view. So it's really so basic that it doesn't matter what we call it. You know, Krishnamurti always said you could put a Coke bottle on the mantelpiece and say, Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola, and make that your worship. So it's a very good point, because language is... it's a tricky business. And so that's something that we can become very attached to. That's something that happens to fundamentalists, that they say, oh, it says right here. I know it's true because it's written right here, and it may be true or maybe not.
It was very helpful what you said about when I read, that it's connecting my mind with the author's mind.
Yes.
But it's true for me.
Yes.
It's not true. It's true for me.
Exactly. Yeah. And you might want to share that and see if other people reflect it too. And then you could have a party or a sangha or something. You know.
Or a poke.
Yeah, or a poke. Well, it's after 8. I'm sorry. I overshot the time. Another word for suffering is unsatisfactory. That's a real good one to think about. So, are there announcements?
So we have a sitting, half-day sitting this coming.
We do.
Saturday at 9 p.m. So, I assume you and Wendy will...
Yes, we will. Yeah.
Okay.
And also, after the sit, there's a informal plan to go out to lunch in the neighborhood. So anybody who wants to join us is welcome. We can talk about it on Saturday.
Well, we're celebrating. Wendy is off tonight because she's celebrating her birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And Ellie's Ellie's had her birthday, and I have
so
too.
We sometimes have a little Gemini birthday thing, but everybody is welcome. Anybody who has time to join.
So come with us if you can. Yeah.
It'll be low-key. I mean, we're just... Wendy suggested the Park Station Hashery. Have you been there, Jeffrey?
Which one?
It's called the Park Station Hashery over on...
I know the chef.
It's okay, you think?
I haven't been there
myself.
Well,
but you know the chef.
But
right?
I just... Yeah,
it's not fancy.
The chef came from the garage in Negley Park, many a day.
Okay.
And yeah, so...
Well, it looks like a diner, kind of diner menu, but with some really
it's
nice
gone
vegetarian
many, it's gone through many transformations.
Okay.
Most recently, it had been an Italian restaurant.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, that's
so
the plan.
I'm looking, I would love to join you, but...
Well,
if
you can't, yeah, do. I mean, we'll... I don't know exactly when we'll be there, but sometime probably between 12:30 and 1.
Mm-hmm.
We'll set up here.
Yeah. We'll set up the chairs and go over there. All right, let's do a 1-minute sit.